Too much distraction here. Hi, my name is Pat Yeo, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. I like that whole whiskey meal. It's like a Madonna or somebody, you know. The security detail will be handling all of this. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. My sobriety date is August 28, 1975. I never in my wildest dreams thought I was going to be here this long. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't stand living the way I was living one more day, and I didn't have any real hope that anything was going to change, but I didn't, thank God, I didn't have a better idea, and so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything's changed. I started drinking when I was 13. The reason I drank that day is I was at a party, and people were drinking, and I wanted them to like me, so I drank. Presumably, they did like me. They were my friends, but I've never felt... You know, I've always felt different. I've always felt ill at ease. I've described myself as being shy my whole life. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you call things by different names. You call that self-obsession. I like shy better. Shy implies I can't really help it. I was born that way, you know. But self-obsession is what it is. I think about me all the time. How do I look? How do I sound? What are you thinking about me? And so I'm at this party feeling all that. Somebody handed me a rum and Coke, and it went away. You know, I relaxed, I think, for the first time in my life, more than relaxed, as it turned out. I was able to talk to people at that party. I said funny things that made people laugh. I got up and danced and felt like the best dancer there, and it was magic. I blacked out. I passed out. I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. Now, that was a lot more than I meant to do that night. The girls in my crowd were not behaving this way. I felt embarrassed and ashamed and guilty. I was terrified I'd get pregnant. Imagine the bad feelings a girl might have under that set of circumstances. And I had all those bad feelings. And yet, I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without a second thought. I was apparently willing to pay the price to drink from the gate. You know, I certainly didn't think any of that through at the time. If it sounds like I have insight to my life, believe me, I didn't have it when I was living it. You know, it all came later after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a periodic for a while, mostly because of my age. I didn't have access to alcohol every day. But I found, you know, we're like, I think, magnets for each other. You know, I don't ever remember asking anybody, where do you get a phony ID? But I became possessed of one that said, I don't know, I was 35 or something, and I found out the one liquor store in Newport Beach where I grew up in California that would sell to minors out the back door on a ridiculous ID like that. I drank at every possible opportunity, and my behavior when drinking never got much better than that first night. As I like to describe it, when I drink, I become friendly. And so I developed this reputation in school for being a friendly girl, and, you know, that's not exactly how I wanted to be thought of. I wanted people to admire and respect me. I meant to grow up and get married and stay married to that person forever. You know, I had ideas of how I wanted to live my life, but I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I kind of know it's not happening for me. I did get married when I was 18 because somebody asked. He was a perfectly nice boy, man, whatever. We were divorced when I was 18 and a half. For years, I said that we were too, you know, we never should have gotten married. We were too young. And then after I was sober, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, I sort of amended that to say that I was too young. You know, I think he was probably just fine, but I was too young and immature. And I've now come to believe that the real reason why I left him is I needed to drink more than I needed to be married to him. We were a young married couple, didn't have much money, and we couldn't afford it. We would do this horrible thing. We would get together with friends, like to play cards or something, and there'd be four or six of us, and we would have one bottle of wine, and we would... Do people actually do this? We would like mix it with 7-Up or something to stretch it to go for this. It's a terrible thing to do. It's a crime, really, is what it is. And so you never really, you just had that little taste, but you never could really get a buzz. It was awful. I wasn't real clear on any of this. I couldn't have said to him, he asked, why are you leaving? And I couldn't answer him. I didn't know. But it is very clear to me today, I left because I needed to drink. And so I got divorced, and I... moved to Los Angeles, which was, you know, about 50 miles away, and I got a job in an apartment. I was 18 and a half years old, and I started drinking daily. I was working as a secretary in a trucking company. I drank with these truck drivers. I behaved there on that job exactly the way I'd behaved in high school, which is to say, before I left that job, I knew most of those truck drivers. My father was vice president of that company, which is how I got the job, and I caused him a lot of embarrassment. He called me one day on the phone to talk to me about my behavior, and, you know, I can't talk to my father about this. I can't even really think about it really too much myself. I certainly can't talk to him about it. And so I said some really terrible things to him on the phone that day just to get him to hang up, because I was so uncomfortable in this conversation. And the end result of that is I left the job, and I didn't speak to my father again except when absolutely forced to at weddings and funerals and, you know, things like that, until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and made amends to him. It was actually the first amends I made. When I made my amends list, my sponsor said, which one of these do you think would be the easiest? And I said, oh, hands down, my father, because he was a real spiritual guy, and I knew that whatever I said or did, it would be well and lovingly received. And so she said, well, it's good to start with one that you think might go easy. So I made amends to him, and we had a good relationship until he died a few years ago, and that just because of you. You know, because I never would have spoken to him again. I wouldn't have. I left that job, and I can describe my whole working career. I worked as a secretary, and I'm a very good secretary. When I was 23 years old, I was working as a legal secretary, making really, really good money for somebody that age, and had a very bright future in that industry. My last job, I got sober when I was 30 years old, and my last job was as a clerk in a YMCA, and my job there was, if you were a member of that Y and you came in to pay your dues, I'm the person that wrote you the receipt, and I was barely hanging onto that job by the skin of my teeth. You know, my life was going nowhere, absolutely nowhere. Here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night, and we were bar hopping around downtown LA, and I think we were all drunk. But I know for sure I was probably the drunkest, because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. I know you'll understand when I explain this to you. It's not really my fault. We were in this place, and the stage was like here where I'm standing, and we were sitting at this table right in front, and there were, I don't know, 8 or 10 of us in our group there, and I had excused myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall behind the stage, and I bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway and made some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment, and he said something along the lines of, if I thought I was such hot stuff, which apparently I thought. So a moment ago, I was sitting at the table here with my boss and my coworkers, and now moments later, I'm dressed kind of like I am now, and then moments later, I'm on the stage essentially dressed in nothing. And there was that moment when my boss's eye and mine met, when he realized who that was up there. Seriously, I'll never forget the look on his face ever. You know, it's in there forever. When I sobered up the next day, I couldn't believe I had done that. I mean, a strip joint, this is beyond tacky, but it gave me ideas. This is when go-go dancing was becoming popular. I don't even know if go-go dancing ever was popular. It wasn't my crowd. Go-go dancing, in my mind's eye, seemed ever so much classier than stripping. It is not, let me be clear, but I was pretty sure at the time that it was. So I actually went and got a paid job as a go-go dancer. Now, there were all the nice clubs on the Sunset Strip had go-go dancers at this time. I did not work in any of those nice clubs. My first paid job as a dancer was in a club on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody there who spoke English. I have no idea how I got the job, or for that matter, what I was even doing there. But I got hired there and was working as an entertainer. And then I moved uptown to, I say uptown because they spoke English in the next place. I met the man who was to become my second husband there at Nick's, this next bar where I was working. He was a customer, and clearly recognized talent, and I can't even say that with a straight face. The kind of clubs I worked in, dancing ability was not necessarily a requirement, and I'm not really all that great, you know. So anyway, he's like the most inappropriate man for me in the state of California, so of course we moved right in together and set up housekeeping, and eventually we did get married. We had this really romantic wedding in Las Vegas by a judge who was wearing his bedroom slippers. We had sat in the car before we went up to the courthouse and drank a pint of something, you know, before we got married. So now I'm married again, but I'm a full-blown alcoholic by now, and I'm still behaving like I'm single, which, as you might guess, caused some problems in the marriage. We had a lot of problems in our marriage, a lot of fights, a lot of unhappiness. I started getting arrested. I can't believe this is happening to me. I'm a nice girl from Newport Beach, you know, but nice girls like me don't get arrested. Well, I hadn't been a nice girl in a long time, actually. But I, my first arrest was on a Thanksgiving night. I had been to Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' home, which was about 50 miles away. My husband wasn't invited. Did I mention my family was unhappy about this marriage? So he wasn't invited. He had he was a chef, and he his boss, the owner of the restaurant, had a Thanksgiving Day party for those employees. So he went to that in Beverly Hills. I went to my parents in Newport. And my parents were big drinkers, so I got drunk at their house and over Thanksgiving dinner, and I was driving home, and I stopped to buy cigarettes. Now, where else would you stop except a bar to buy cigarettes? Only an AA would heads nod when you say a ridiculous thing like that. And this bar happened to be on Main Street in downtown LA, which is Skid Row. Not in a direct line from where my parents lived to where I was living, but nonetheless, that is the place I chose to purchase my cigarettes. And of course, you can't just go in and ask for change for the cigarette machine. That would be rude. So I sat down and had a few more drinks, and long story short, I came out of the bar and I got arrested for common drunk. And they took me to Sybil Brand, which was the women's jail at that time. And now there's a scary place. I was in way over my head. I mean, there are scary women in there. And they told me I could make a phone call, and I remembered where my husband was and at this party. So I called his boss's house, and the boss's wife answered the phone. And I identified myself and told her I was in jail. Could she have my husband come bail me out? It did not occur to me that it might have been kinder to ask to speak directly to him. And yet, you know, when I came to AA years later, I remember early on sitting in meetings, hearing you talk about making amends and thinking to myself, no, I can't really think of anybody that I hurt. Oh, my God. If I knew you 5 minutes, I'd probably hurt you because I am selfish and self-centered. I'd care nothing about you. Nothing. Anyway, my next arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing. You know, I've told that story for years from podiums, and my husband said to me one time, you know, you should make it clear, Pat, that there were no animals involved. It had never occurred to me that that's what people were thinking, maybe. There were no animals involved, okay? Still, it wasn't really a really good thing to happen. Let's just say I'm grateful I had a lot of money on me that night, or you might have a different speaker. I might still be in Tijuana, you know, trying to get out of jail. You kind of get the idea. Things were, I guess you could sum it up by saying I was not drinking like a lady, okay? That would be a good way of summing it up. And I'm in this terrible marriage with this guy, and I started drinking at home a lot, more than out. He was a gambler, and so he was gone a lot at night at the racetrack and poker games or wherever it is that gamblers go, and I actually kind of preferred it now when he was gone, because when he was there, I felt like I needed to make the drinking look different. He was a drinker. I mean, I met him in a bar, but he didn't drink as much as I did and was not an alcoholic. So when he was there, it was I remember it as a lot of work. You know, scotch is my drink of choice, although I'll drink anything, but assuming we have scotch, you know, you go in the kitchen, you put some ice in the glass and some scotch and water. There's sort of a right color a drink should be. I'm not really exactly sure what color that is, but I know there is a right color. And then the really hard part is you're back out in the living room with this drink, and there's a reasonable period of time that this drink should last. there isn't a person in this room who knows what that period of time is. You know? So when he was gone, it was just easier. I just take that bottle and put it on the table by where I sat. I mean, I used a glass. I'm not a common drunk, but I didn't have to ice and all that nonsense, you know. And I would play those sad records over and over again. I was particularly fond of Ray Charles' Born to Lose. Oh, I'd play it and cry and feel sorry for myself. And then sometimes I'd call people on the phone. Yeah. Some of you too, huh? If you're a phone caller, or if you're an Al-Anon and took the calls, you know that this never happens at 7:30 in the evening. You know, it's always 2 or 3 in the morning, and it's usually completely inappropriate people. I've heard speakers say they called the White House and demanded to speak to the president. You know, I didn't do that. I called people I knew. A boyfriend I had when I was 12. I wonder where Danny is these days. Of course, I have no idea where Danny is these days. So I wake up a number of other people, you know, trying to track him down. And I'm pretty sure he and his wife were happy to hear from me when I finally caught up to them. My mother would take those calls in the middle of the night. My mother has always loved me, has always tried to help me. I broke her heart over and over and over again. I would call her with these drunken middle-of-the-night phone calls, and she would try to say something that would, essentially something that would change my life, not knowing that there's nothing that you can say or do for anybody that's in that state of mind and body that's going to make any difference, you know. And I'll tell you, if I got nothing else out of Alcoholics Anonymous but that I'm sober and I stopped tormenting my mother, I would have been overpaid right there, you know. Anyway, life went on, you know. I was drinking pretty much in this rocking chair in my living room in this purple flannel bathrobe every day. I had this little job that I mentioned that I was going to. I wasn't there a lot of Mondays. I often drank at lunchtime, and when you drink at lunchtime, it's bad. One or two things happen. Either you go back to work or you don't, and either way, it's not necessarily good. And had a lot of trouble there, and, you know, I hated my husband. I wasn't getting along with my parents. There was nothing about my life that was working, nothing. I remember sitting in my apartment one hot summer day. I was watching the neighbors next door. We lived in a second floor apartment. I could see into their backyard from my chair where I sat. And they were a young couple about my age, late 20s maybe at the time. And they had two small children, and the children were playing in the sprinklers on the lawn. And the parents were sitting on the porch steps laughing and talking, and I watched those people that day, and I cried because that's how I meant to be living my life. I don't know how this happened to me. I never, ever meant to be living this terrible life that I am living, and yet here I am, you know. I knew that day watching those neighbors that it was never going to change because I had by then been trying not to drink on my own, and I couldn't stop. I simply could not stop. You know, the hangovers were getting worse, things that were happening to me were getting worse. You know, I wanted to quit, but I couldn't. You know, I'd wake up in the morning saying to myself, today's the day. I'm not going to drink. But I'm an alcoholic, you know, and assuming I get through lunch without drinking, which maybe I do, maybe I don't, but let's say I do, by nightfall, by the time I get off work, I need a drink. You know, I would come home from work, I would walk in, I can just see it like it happened yesterday. I'd walk, open the door to the apartment, put my keys in my purse on the table, walk through the living room and the dining room straight to the kitchen where the bottle of scotch would be sitting, pick up the bottle of scotch, have a drink. Now I'm okay, now I can settle in, tomorrow I'll stop. There's this half a bottle of scotch here. Nobody could quit with a half a bottle of anything sitting there. I'll drink this down, tomorrow there'll be nothing, and then I'll quit tomorrow. But I'm an alcoholic, and before that night's out, I get nervous as the level of that bottle goes down, and I'm calling the liquor store to deliver a new one, and tomorrow what I have is more or less a half a fifth of scotch, and I did it day after day. One night I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what triggered, well, God probably, but I didn't know who had triggered the notion to call AA that night, but I did, and a real nice man answered the phone and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol, and I said that I was. I was drunk when I called, and he wanted to send some women to my house, and I said, oh, no, I don't think I'm that bad, and he seemed to understand, and he said, do you think you could not, he asked where I lived, and he said, do you think you could not take a drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night that's not far from your home, and I said, yes, I could do that. Now, I doubt very much that I cannot take a drink tomorrow. I drink every day. But obviously, yes was the right answer, so I said yes. He talked to me a long time, and we eventually hung up, and of course, I continued to drink. And the next morning, I came to, and I remembered making the call, and I remembered parts of the conversation, and I found the piece of paper with the address of the meeting place. Now, in the light of day, I was pretty sure I'd been a little premature there. I'm 30 years old. I'm almost certain that's too young to be an alcoholic. And let me just say, when I got sober, 30 was considered one of the young people, not so much anymore. I mean, I know 30-year-olds who are sober, I don't know, 40 years, you know, but... but I was considered one of the young people. But I did. Of course, I know nothing about AA, and I'm thinking I'm way too young. But somehow I found myself at the dinner table that night saying to my husband, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. He said something really loving to me, like, yeah, whatever. We were not getting along. And he went off to wherever he went, and I went to my first meeting. I had no idea that my life was about to change. Really had no idea at all. I'm all emotional today. It was a big meeting, maybe 350 people in the basement of a church. It might as well have been 30,000 people. You know, I saw y'all going down the steps, and I thought, there is no way I can get out of this car and do this. I'm like, I didn't drink that day. The guy on the phone said, don't drink. So I'm like stark raving sober. It's 8:28 at night for an 8:30 meeting. You don't want to get there too early because you would have to talk to people, and I can't talk to you sober. So it's 8:28, and I'm like stark raving sober, and somehow I got out of the car, and I went down those basement steps. There was a man standing at the door. God, I don't do this. There was a man standing at the door who put out his hand and said, hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It made me feel welcome. I believe that that is the single most important thing anybody ever does in an AA meeting. It made me feel welcome. Now I'm in the room. It's 8:29, and you all are kissing and hugging as we do, and I'm, you know, like a deer in headlights. And a man came out of the crowd and asked me if I was new. I couldn't imagine how he knew that, and I acknowledged that I was, and he got me a seat in the back of the room and a big book, whatever in the world a big book might be. And the meeting started. It was a speaker meeting. The speaker that night was a man by the name of Norm A. And I love saying his name in meetings because the old-timers always smile when you say his name. He hooked me. I was sitting way in the back of this room. He talked really, really fast. And I was sitting in the back of this room, and I was leaning forward in my chair so I wouldn't miss anything he said. And I became aware of that, and I thought, wow, I'm really, like, here. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm really in the room here. And he said something that just made me laugh like I couldn't remember ever having laughed before. And of course, it was laughter of identification. And when the meeting was over, we all stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And at the end of the prayer, these two nice people on either side of me squeezed my hand when they said, keep coming back. I thought that was the nicest thing. I didn't know the whole room was doing that. I thought it was just these two people. And I was really touched. The minute they dropped my hands, I was out the door. There's no way I can stay and chat with you. I'm sober. I mean, I'm not drinking. I don't do chit-chat. I have none. None, you know. And so I shot out the door to my car. I had the big book. I stayed up most of that night reading it, and I remember thinking, I'm going to go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you say go to a lot of meetings, and come on, every Saturday's a lot. And I didn't drink till Friday. Saturday to Friday, I didn't drink. I remember every day thinking, wow, AA really works. This is great. And then on Friday night, I was drunk. And I went back Saturday night to the meeting. I raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety again. And I got phone numbers the first night, but I didn't call. I don't know you. Why would I call you? You know, what would I say? But I got more phone numbers this night, and one of these ladies said, you might want to actually call one of us. You don't seem to be doing too well on your own. I drank a couple more times that week, and I called her on Wednesday night, I guess, Tuesday, I guess, whatever, a couple of days later. And she said, and I was drunk when I called her, and she said, you don't seem to be doing well at all. I suggest you get a sponsor. Most of us have found that to be pretty helpful. And I said, well, how do I get a sponsor? And she said, I'll be your sponsor. Now, you know, her enthusiasm for leaping on that job should have been a clue to me that I probably wasn't going to like it much. But I totally missed that sign, you know. I said, oh, okay, and what do I do? And she said, do you have a big book? I said, yes. And she said, bring it with you and meet me tomorrow night, and we will talk. Tomorrow night early before the meeting. Tomorrow night was a Thursday. That's not meeting night, but kind of sensed that I maybe shouldn't point that out to her. So I agreed, and I met her the next night, and that was August 28, 1975, and my life began that night. The first thing she did is she took my copy of the book, and she opened it to the front cover and told me to write that day's date in there. I wrote it in there. She said, that's your sobriety date. I thought, I shouldn't have done that in ink. I don't think that's... It is my sobriety date. The next thing she did is she got a meeting directory that lists the meetings in the area, and she circled a meeting for every night of the week and said, on Monday you'll go here and Tuesday there, and I stopped her midweek or so, and I said, you know, I can't do that. I'm a married woman. My husband is not happy that I'm at this meeting tonight. Just this one meeting tonight, I absolutely cannot go every night. It's completely out of the question. She was very, very sweet to me that night, as I remember it. That can't be true because she never was again, but it does seem like she was sweet to me that night. And she said something like, well, perhaps you can do it on less, but if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do, and this is what I do. My life hung in the balance. I didn't, when I think about it now, I get chills. That conversation is where my life could have taken a whole different turn. But I agreed to do what she was saying. Now, if you're new, this is important. I didn't agree happily, and I definitely didn't do it happily, but I did it, and that's why I'm standing here almost 42 years later. Excuse me one second here. Just giving the signers a little break. Oh my God, we've lost one. Now I forgot where I was. oh, I'm new, yeah. Crazy, crying all the time. I started going to meetings every night, and my husband didn't like it. He thought I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, I'd been cheating on him all the years we'd been married. I noticed that there were men in AA, and I was not opposed to the idea of getting better acquainted with some of you gentlemen. But none of the men in AA seemed to be interested in me, which really hurt my feelings. And it made me especially mad that my husband was accusing me of something I was not actually doing right at that minute, you know? And so I felt really, really sorry for myself. I cried all the time at meetings, all the time in my first year. My sponsor told me I had to get to every meeting 1 hour early, not 55 minutes early, one hour early. And I was to have early commitments like chairs or coffee or cookies, things you do before the meeting. I was to get there 60 minutes early and do my commitment. And then... circulate, after I've done whatever my job is, circulate throughout the room and shake hands with other people as they arrive, ask them how they are as though I care, and get phone numbers of three women that I don't already have, and then the next day following the meeting, in addition to calling my sponsor, call these three women whose phone numbers I got last night. So I would, my days were also dreary and also like I'd go to work, I'd come home, we'd have dinner, we'd have this huge fight about me going to the meeting, I'd be sobbing hysterically. It's a miracle I wasn't killed in a car accident driving to the meeting because I was sobbing driving to the meeting. And I would think, every night I would think, it's not worth it. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to your stupid meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house tonight, but this is the last time I'm going, I can't do it, it's too hard. And I'd get to the meeting and I'd slam the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever my job was. And then I'd work the room, you know, hi, Debbie, how are you? And, of course, Debbie would say something like, fine, Pat, how are you? And I'd tell her how I was, you know, with great dramatic wrenching sobs, you know, until her eyes would glaze over. And then, hi, Polly, how are you? And, you know, it was painful for me and I'm sure for everybody in the room. Eventually the meeting would start and I would get relief from myself, you know. I always felt just a little tiny bit better by the time I was driving home. I don't remember crying ever on the way home from a meeting. And it's not like there was some magical thing that happened at the podium or from a speaker. It was sometimes it was a little conversation I had maybe with you before the meeting, or maybe even a little snippet of a conversation I overheard. Whatever it was, maybe just the feeling in the room, but whatever it was, I always felt just a little bit better on the way home, and I kept coming back. I didn't like any of the directions my sponsor was giving me. I remember she told me, I just want to say, I think of sponsor direction as having this sort of ripple effect. If you're like me, and your sponsor gives you a direction, and you do it today, you want to feel better by tomorrow at the latest, from whatever the situation is. It's never worked that way for me. My sponsor gives me a direction today, and I incorporate that action into my life, whatever it is, and I'm going to give you an example in a minute, and somewhere down the road that I cannot even possibly predict on this day, that action is going to be to my benefit. So one of the things that she had me do when I was new was to pick up these two old ladies. I believe they were about my age now, Claire and Zelda, and bring them to the meeting on Thursday nights. Claire and Zelda lived in the same apartment building, not as me, as each other. And of course, it was not convenient anywhere to where I lived. And I was way out of my way, and I felt very put upon. I didn't like Claire and Zelda. I would pick them up. I would drive them to the meeting, let them out of the car, and we would go in the meeting, and I would never speak to them again. Now the meeting would be over, and they would be standing by the door, politely waiting, so I wouldn't have to wait on them to go home. And I would deliberately go over here and start a new conversation with somebody and leave these ladies standing there. I was so mean-spirited about the whole thing, but I did it because my sponsor told me I had to. And one night I went to pick them up. I don't know how long I'd been doing it, 5 or 6 months maybe, and I went to pick them up, and Zelda was sick, so just Claire and I went to the meeting. And the next day I was at work, and I found myself thinking about Zelda and wondering if she was okay. And so I called her, and as I'm dialing the phone, I'm thinking, boy, that just dated me, you know, dialing. I'm thinking, why am I calling her? I don't even like her. What do I care if she's sick? But I did care. And that was the beginning of me learning how to be a friend to you. I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I thought I was just giving rides to two old ladies. I got to stop using that term, old ladies, because it's making me really uncomfortable. Those phone calls, you know, I told you my sponsor told me to make 3 phone calls. I never got the point of that for the longest time. I was so uncomfortable calling you. I didn't know what I'd say to you. My fear was you weren't going to know who I was. I could have said, hi, I'm the girl who cried through the whole meeting last night, and I know you would have known who I was, but I never thought to say that, you know. But I would sit by the phone really sweating, thinking about calling you, and finally I'd take a giant inhale, I'd dial your number, and you'd answer, and in one giant exhale, I'd say something like, hi, my name is Pat, I have long brown hair and glasses, I'm new, I met you at the meeting last night, my sponsor told me I had to call 3 people every day, and you're one of them, so how are you anyway? Now, I don't even, did you get that? I don't know if anybody understood a word I said, but they all seemed to get that I was new. And everybody was kind to me. And I always felt a little bit better after I hung up the phone. They weren't long conversations. My favorite was a woman named Mary Ann, who is started becoming my friend during this phone conversation and remains my dear friend to this day, because she made me laugh in that phone conversation. I was not laughing much at all. And so I was forever grateful to her. She's also the person who, when I was about 1.5 years sober, I was standing in line to thank a speaker, crying, because that's what I did. And she turned to me in line. Now, this is my memory. She doesn't remember it quite this way. She turned to me, looked down her nose. I swear this is the way it happened. Looked down her nose and said to me in this tone of voice, oh, and how is the Queen of Tragedy tonight? I wanted her to like me. You know, I'll tell you what, that's the night that I started acting better than I felt. You know, that's the night that I, you know, got it, that I don't have to, like, do this all the time. I'm so grateful to her. Anyway, my husband and I are fighting all the time about Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, it was inevitable that I would meet a man in a meeting who looked good to me. I mean, I actually had met many, but one that looked back. I was about 10 months sober, and the gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came in the room the first night, and he had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head. Oh, my heart started to pound. I leapt across a couple of chairs to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed. And, you know, I went over to my sponsor, and she said, "Pat, let's not forget you're a married woman." I said, "Yeah, but I am really unhappy." And she said, "Nonetheless, you're married, and as long as you're married, I expect you to act married." I said, "I do not see this as a problem. I will get divorced." And she said, No. We in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. You just stay married and act married. Well, I was obsessed with this man. I know you understand obsession if you're in this room. Whether you're an Al-Anon or an AA, I know you understand it. Why would God get him sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? I knew you'd understand. So we began I refer to this as the death dance now. If you've been here a month, you've either done this or seen it done. It starts with the deep, meaningful glances across the room at each other. And then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line often. And then he's walking me to my car after the meeting. And then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting. And it's a little complicated to get together. I mean, you know, I'm a married woman, obviously. We're not going to my place. And he's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place. Doesn't matter, though. We're very resourceful people. I was working at a record company in Hollywood. He was very conveniently working in Hollywood also at a porn bookstore. You cannot make this stuff up. Honest to God, you just can't. So I arranged this long lunch hour at work one day for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I went to the bookstore and picked him up, and we went to a motel together, and let's just say got to know each other better, and I drove him back to the bookstore, dropped him off. I was driving back to my office that afternoon, and it occurred to me in the car that I was 10 months sober, and I was living exactly the way I had always lived. I'd been sitting in meetings for 10 months hearing you say pretty much every night that I was going to have to change everything about the way I'd been living, or I was probably going to drink. And I knew that day I was in a lot of trouble because, you know, now I'm sober 10 months and nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. I was scared to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she'd been very, very, very clear in her direction about this guy. But I've been here long enough to know I don't want to drink. And so that night I told my sponsor what had happened. And she said, "You know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you didn't have to pick up a drink today to find that out. And you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to." Here's the thing. I never wanted to live that way. Drunk or sober, I didn't like living that way. Wanting doesn't change a thing. You know, I don't get how you in Alcoholics Anonymous are going to help me. I don't get any of this. My life seems just, the problems just seem insurmountable. Here's what I did. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. That's it. You kind of wanted more, didn't you? I know I did when she told me that was the answer. A day at a time, I didn't drive by that bookstore. A day at a time, I didn't take his calls when he called me. A day at a time, when I saw him in meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, this means we never got closer than the entire length of my arm. I thought I should explain to him what was happening. Fortunately, ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, "Oh, no. I think he'll get the idea." And I heard, really heard for the first time, that line is that is read in almost every meeting I go to from the big book, "Half measures avail us nothing." And I knew for me, this was going to be the big one. For me, I was going to have to do this 100% way or her way, or I was most certainly going to drink. I knew it. And so I did it 100% her way. I stayed away from that guy. Of course, the obsession passed, because obsessions always pass. But the really good news, and the part that I never dreamed was going to happen, is I don't live that way anymore. You know, what an amazing thing that was. You know, I didn't know that could happen. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober. And I got a new sponsor right away, and this woman was sober a long time. And she said, "I've watched you whine and complain about your husband. I want you a day at a time to act as though you're a kind and loving wife. Just pretend like you love him." It was not an appealing idea. I tried to explain to her I didn't think this marriage could be saved. And she said, "Maybe not." She said, "Maybe you're going to have to walk away at some point, but you owe a lot of amends to that guy." And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very clear on these difficult amends. It says, right there in black and white. You can't make direct demands when to do so would might injure that person or others. And going home and confessing infidelities he may not know about is not an amend. So I became willing to try it her way. She gave me very specific direction. I remember her first direction to me was every day after work when he came home, I was to ask him how his day went and listen while he told me. And my direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. So the first time I'm doing this, I, you know, check my watch. And, so how was your day? And he looked kind of surprised that I was asking, but he told me something that had happened to him at work. Now he's talking about people that I don't know, that I've never had any interest whatsoever in. So the, you know, it's sort of like if a stranger in the back of the room is telling me about their cousin in Duluth or something. I mean, it meant nothing to me, you know. But when the 10 minutes were up, I left the room. But the next night, you know, I did it again. Oh, and let me just say, as I drove to the meeting that night, I wasn't crying. And I thought, why am I not crying? We still had the same fight we always had. Well, I wasn't crying. It took me a long time to figure this out. Because I'd finally gotten my focus off the problem, and I was busy in the solution. And when I get busy in the solution, I always feel better, at least a little bit better, despite what the status of the problem might still be. I, you know, after a while, these little 10-minute things became lengthier, and they became real conversations. Like I could say, well, whatever happened to Tim's little sick baby that you told me about last week, is he better? You know, and now we're having actual real conversations. And, you know, I started watching couples in AA, how they treat each other. And there's good examples and there's bad examples here. I tried to take the good stuff home and practice it in my home. It always, when I'm talking about it, it sounds like, oh, I just did this, became this wonderful wife, up and down for sure, you know, but I, always trying to shoot in the right direction. And one night I was on my knees, I don't know how long it was, months for sure, at least, and I was on my knees thanking God for my sobriety, and I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. It had already happened. This is the biggest problem in my life, and I missed when it ended. I remember thinking, how can that be? Well, the way it can be is I was so busy in the solution, I'd kind of forgotten about the problem, you know? It really made a believer out of me. I got back down on my knees that night, and I thank God for that. I wasn't even sure what I was feeling exactly. I just knew that I was comfortable in that house with that husband, and that if God wanted me to stay married to him, I could do that and stay sober. Thank you, God. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. It seemed really kind of unfair. I remember thinking I wish it would have happened when I hated him. I do not wish that at all. That was a fleeting here and gone thought. He was sick for a year and a half, and I used to say it was the hardest year and a half of my life. That is no longer true, but it was the hardest year and a half up to that point. But it was also far and away the best year and a half of our marriage because you taught me how to do that. When he died, I went to this little chapel and made some funeral arrangements, and a couple of 100 people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon off to be there. They didn't know him, but they came for me, you know, and I realized sitting in that chapel that what my sponsor had promised me had happened. I knew that I had 100, I felt sad obviously that day, but I knew that I had 100% made my amends to him. And I was so grateful that I had stayed when all of my best judgment suggested I should leave. I remember thinking, I don't know if it was that day, but very shortly after, that feeling of knowing for sure that I'd 100% made those amends, it's the payoff for doing the work. You know, how great is that? But here's the thing, that's not even close to the payoff. God's vision for me is so much bigger than anything I can imagine. One of the other speakers talked about that. You know, I started dating Vince, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of you knew him and loved him. We fell in love and got married, and we had almost 30 years together. Of a fabulous time together that would not have been possible had I not learned how to do that with my former husband. You see what I'm saying about God's vision for me? So much bigger. I could not possibly. If you had said to me when I was new, now here's what's going to happen. Your husband's going to die and you're going to fall in love with Vince Yeo and get married and have this wonderful life. You know what I would have said? Oh, don't be silly. That's Vince. He's my friend. Wow. I think Beth has talked about it. You know, whoever dated a friend before, you know, I certainly didn't. I would meet you, have sex, and then maybe embark on a relationship, you know, or not. So anyway, Vince died a number of years ago, and My heart broke. You know, we were both really active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had such a good time together, and you know, that bagpiper last night kind of pushed me over the edge, and I haven't really quite recovered from it yet. When Vince died, my heart broke, and I thought, I don't think I can do this. Here's the thing. It was the next 2 years were the hardest 2 years of my life, drunk or sober, really, really hard years. I missed him so much. I still do, but it's not quite the same. Maybe the most important thing I have to say here today is that never once did the idea of picking up a drink cross my mind. Not once. I mean, not even a fleeting thought. You know, when he died, it was a Tuesday. I made one phone call to somebody who wasn't home, left a message. My house was filled with sober AA members. And I went to my home group meeting the next night, and several people said to me, "Oh, my God, I can't believe you're here. Your husband died last night. Where else would I be except with you at a time like that, you know? You're my family." And, you know, I got through it. My mother, we had moved my mother to an apartment right next door to us. She actually lived 10 steps away from us. I like to say 12 if you took little steps, just because it makes for a better story. And we moved her there, so she didn't want to live with us, but it was close. It was so close that we could take care of her, but everybody had their own space, you know, and it was perfect, perfect arrangement. And she had been sick with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma a couple of years before, and had been in remission, and it came back big time right after Vince died. And so I started having to take her for treatment 5 days a week to Pomona, which is about an hour's drive away. My mother and Vince and I were of one political persuasion, and my mother was of the other. And Vince loved a good political discussion with somebody who was smart and could, you know, intelligently present their side of things. And my mother was certainly a woman who could do that, but she was also a very smart woman, and she knew she never wanted to get in a political argument with her son-in-law, so she never, ever, ever discussed politics in our house. So now Vince is gone, and I'm in the car with my mother 5 days a week driving to Pomona, and she starts talking politics. And I understood after a few days that she thinks now that he's dead, she can change my mind, that he's no longer influencing me, you know? And it really made me mad. But I also got this. I think I mentioned earlier, you know, my mother took all those drunken phone calls. My mother's the one who cleaned up my messes. My mother's the one who drove out to Arizona one time when I just, you know, left town. And, you know, I could go on and on just about the things that the grief, the anguish, the worry, the things we put our mothers through. And so I'm getting mad at her for this, and the thought crossed my head, I don't get to be mad at her. I don't get to argue with her. I've been making daily living amends to her for whatever this was at the time, 35 years, however long it was, and she's in her 90s now, and she's sick, and my whole job here is to make her happy, period. That's it. And so I don't get to argue. So we're in the car, she's talking nonsense, and sorry, Mom. And I'm saying things like, gosh, Mom, I never thought of it that way before. Or, you could be right. Honest to God, the veins are sticking out on my neck. I can't do this. And I'd get out to the hospital where her treatment was. I'd get her settled in her treatment chair, and I would say, I'm just going to step out in the courtyard and call my office and see if there's anything I need to be doing. And I'd step out in the courtyard, and I'd burst into tears just from the strain of not saying anything. And then I'd call a friend on the program who would always make me laugh, and then I'd be fine, and I could go back and be with my mother, and it was all good. And, you know, I'm happy to report that when she died, I'm pretty sure she thinks she had changed my mind by then. And I don't know, that somehow just warms my heart, you know. After Vince died, we had this dream to retire to the Palm Springs area, and you know, when I retired from my job a few years after he died, I thought, do I really want to do that? Am I going to like it without him, or is it going to be awful? You know, I didn't know. It was scary, and it was scary. I'd been in the same home group for 36 years. It's real scary to move away from that, I'll tell you. But before I moved, I knew three meetings for sure that, because I'd visited out there a lot, so I knew three meetings for sure that I thought would be regular meetings of mine. They remain that to this day. They are regular meetings of mine. I did everything that I know to do to make my transition with AA as smooth as I possibly could, because I knew that was the most important thing. And I'm very happy to report that I love it. It's a little hot out there, although we don't have your humidity. Jesus, God, how do you live in this? Whatever. Did I just swear at the podium? I mean, I can't even. Anyway, I'll just tell one other little story, and then I'm going to dash off to the airport. My whole life, I have been a couch potato. I mean, I have always had these good intentions. Vince was a big exerciser, and he was always trying to encourage me to exercise, and I had good intentions, but I just never did it, you know. So now I'm retired, and I'm thinking, well, I at least could take a walk, you know. There's, like, no excuse. And so I started taking these little walks in the neighborhood, and then my friend Linda, who's a big backpacker, said to me, have you ever heard of the Camino de Santiago? And I said, no, I have not. And she said, well, go home and Google it and then call me and tell me what you think. And so I did that, and I said, oh, Linda, I want to do this. Now, the Camino de Santiago, for those of you who are not familiar, is a spiritual pilgrimage in Spain. It's a 500-mile walk. You start in southern France, you cross the Pyrenees Mountains, and then all across northern Spain. And so she, now I'm not an exerciser, and she said, you know, you're going to have to train real hard. We're going to be walking like 15 to 20 miles a day every day. And I said, yeah, I know. And she said, well, I'll train you. I said, great, because she knows what she's doing. So we have a year to train for this event. And so we go out the first day, and we went on, I think, maybe a 2-mile walk, not even really a hike. I mean, it was kind of a walk. We get back almost, we're like from here to the back of the room from the car. I can actually see the car, but I can't make it. Just can't do it. There's this big rock, and I sat on this rock, and I'm all hunched down on this rock. I've drunk all my water, all her water. I'm dying here. And she's a photographer as well, and she memorialized this moment with a photo. Actually still have that hanging in my refrigerator, and I love looking at it because it reminds me of, you know, what you can do. Eventually she got me off the rock and into the car, and we're driving home, and I said to her, I bet you're thinking you picked the wrong person to do this little adventure with. And she said, oh no, you'll be fine. It's a year away. She told me many, many months later that she thought, oh my God, what have I done? I trained hard. For a year I trained hard. And a couple of years ago, we found ourselves in southern France, laying in bed. The window was open. I could see the Pyrenees Mountains, where we're going to be hiking tomorrow. There's this terrible lightning storm. And when I say lightning storm, I don't mean an occasional lightning strike. I mean lightning. We're going to be hiking there tomorrow. I'm thinking we're dead. You know, we are dying tomorrow. She, on the other hand, is taking pictures of it all. It's so wonderful. And so we started out, and it was amazing. It was amazing, you know. It was really amazing. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get this great. I'd read tons of books and blogs of people who have done this, and everybody has this spiritual experience when they get to the cathedral in Santiago at the end of the journey. And so I'm looking for my spiritual experience for sure. And the third day, so we crossed the Pyrenees Mountains. Now the third day we're out there, and we'd been hiking about maybe 14 miles, and we'd stopped to rest and got up to, you know, put our shoes back on and started walking. And I said to Linda, I feel so fantastic right this minute. I can't believe that I'm doing this. I can't believe that I trained hard enough that I can do it. This is like the most fantastic experience of my life. About 5 minutes later, I fell. And it ended, just to make a long story short, it ended. Went up in the emergency room in Pamplona and eventually came home. And when I came home, all my friends said, oh, I'm so sorry you didn't get your spiritual experience. Well, here's the thing. First of all, you can't, as it turns out, plan when you're going to have a spiritual experience. You would think I would know that. Whatever. And actually, I did have my spiritual experience. You know, I had it there 5 minutes before I fell. I would actually do it over again if I knew it was going to end exactly that way, because it was such a powerful thing. What that trip has done for me is it's made me, I think, a lifetime lover of hiking. I hike all the time, and I love it. And who knew? Who knew that that would happen? You know, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you here. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. My life is so good. As I've said, there's been ups and downs. I mean, that's life. You know, life happens here. What's promised is that we can live through it all with a measure of grace and dignity. dignity and certainly with sobriety. If you're new, I hope that you stay here. I am certainly happy that I have. Thank you.